A Quaker friend kindly informed him that he had left something off. Franklin was often guilty of pride, the friend said, citing many examples, and could be overbearing and rather insolent. So Franklin added humility to be the 13th virtue on his list. Imitate Jesus and Socrates. The descriptions, such as the notably lenient one for chastity, were rather revealing. So, too, was the endeavor itself. It was also in its passion for self-improvement through diligent resolve, enchantingly American. Franklin's focus was on traits that could help him succeed in this world instead of ones that would exalt his soul for the hereafter. Franklin celebrated a characteristically bourgeois set of virtues, writes social theorist David Brooks. These are not heroic virtues. They don't fire the imagination or arouse the passions like the aristocratic love of honor. They are not particularly spiritual virtues, but they are practical, and they are democratic. The set of virtues was also, as Edmund Morgan and others have pointed out, somewhat selfish. It did not include benevolence or charity, for example. But in fairness, we must remember that this was a young tradesman's plan for self-improvement, not a full-blown statement of his morality. Benevolence was and would continue to be a motivating ideal for him, and charity, as Morgan notes, was actually the guiding principle of Franklin's life. The fundamental tenet of his morality, he repeatedly declared, was, "The most acceptable service to God is doing good to man." Mastering all of these 13 virtues at once was a task of more difficulty than I had imagined, Franklin recalled. The problem was that while my care was employed in guarding against one fault, I was often surprised by another. So he decided to tackle them like a person who, having a garden to weed, does not attempt to eradicate all the bad herbs at once, which would exceed his reach and his strength, but works on one of the beds at a time. On the pages of a little notebook, he made a chart with 7 red columns for the days of the week and 13 rows labeled with his virtues. Infractions were marked with a black spot. The first week he focused on temperance, trying to keep that line clear while not worrying about the other lines. With that virtue strengthened, he could turn his attention to the next one, silence, hoping that the temperance line would stay clear as well. In the course of the year, he would complete the 13-week cycle 4 times. I was surprised to find myself so much fuller of faults than I had imagined, he dryly noted. In fact, his notebook became filled with holes as he erased the marks in order to reuse the pages. So he transferred his charts to ivory tablets that could be more easily wiped clean. His greatest difficulty was with the virtue of order. He was a sloppy man, and he eventually decided that he was so busy and had such a good memory that he didn't need to be too orderly. He likened himself to the hurried man who goes to have his axe polished, but after a while loses patience and declares, "I think I like a speckled axe best." In addition, as he recounted with amusement, he developed another convenient rationalization. Something that pretended to be reason was every now and then suggesting to me that such extreme nicety as I exacted of myself might be a kind of foppery in morals, which, if it were known, would make me ridiculous, that a perfect character might be attended with the inconvenience of being envied and hated. Humility was also a problem. I cannot boast of much success in acquiring the reality of this virtue, but I had a good deal with regard to the appearance of it, he wrote, echoing what he had said about how he had acquired the appearance of industry by carting his own paper through the streets of Philadelphia. "There is perhaps no one of our natural passions so hard to subdue as pride. Disguise it, struggle with it, beat it down, stifle it, mortify it as much as one pleases, it is still alive, and will every now and then peep out and show itself." This battle against pride would challenge and amuse him for the rest of his life. You will see it perhaps often in this history. For even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome it, I would probably be proud of my humility. Indeed, he would always indulge a bit of pride in discussing his moral perfection project. 50 years later, as he flirted with the ladies of France, he would pull out the old ivory slates and show off his virtues, causing one French friend to exult at touching this precious booklet. Enlightenment Creed. This plan for pursuing virtue, combined with the religious outlook that he had simultaneously been formulating, laid the foundation for a lifelong creed. It was based on pragmatic humanism and a belief in a benevolent but distant deity who was best served by being benevolent to others. Franklin's ideas never ripened into a profound moral or religious philosophy. He focused on understanding virtue rather than God's grace, and he based his creed on rational utility rather than religious faith. His outlook contained some vestiges of his Puritan upbringing, most notably an inclination toward frugality, lack of pretense, and a belief that God appreciates those who are industrious. But he detached these concepts from Puritan orthodoxy about the salvation of the elect and from other tenets that he did not consider useful in improving earthly conduct. His life shows, the Yale scholar A. Whitney Griswold has noted, what Puritan habits detached from Puritan beliefs were capable of achieving. He was also less inward-looking than Cotton Mather or other Puritans. Indeed, he poked fun at professions of faith that served little worldly purpose. As A. Owen Aldrich writes, "The Puritans were known for their constant introspection, fretting about sins, real or imaginary, and agonizing about the uncertainty of their salvation. Absolutely none of this soul-searching appears in Franklin. One can scrutinize his work from first page to last without finding a single note of spiritual anxiety." Likewise, he had little use for the sentimental subjectivity of the Romantic era, with its emphasis on the emotional and inspirational, that began rising in Europe and then America during the latter part of his life. As a result, he would be criticized by such romantic exemplars as Keats, Carlyle, Emerson, Thoreau, Poe, and Melville. Instead, he fits squarely into the tradition, indeed was the first great American exemplar, of the Enlightenment and its Age of Reason. That movement, which rose in Europe in the late 17th century, was defined by an emphasis on reason and observable experience, a mistrust of religious orthodoxy and traditional authority, and an optimism about education and progress. To this mix, Franklin added elements of his own pragmatism. He was able, as novelist John Updike and historian Henry Steele Commager, among others, have noted, to appreciate the energies inherent in Puritanism, and to liberate them from rigid dogma so they could flower in the free-thinking atmosphere of the Enlightenment. In his writings about religion over the next 5 decades, Franklin rarely displayed much fervor. This is largely because he felt it was futile to wrestle with theological questions about which he had no empirical evidence and thus no rational basis for forming an opinion. Thunderbolts from heaven were, for him, something to be captured by a kite string and studied. As a result, he was a prophet of tolerance. Focusing on doctrinal disputes was divisive, he felt, and trying to ascertain divine certainties was beyond our mortal ken. Nor did he think that such endeavors were socially useful. The purpose of religion should be to make men better and to improve society, and any sect or creed that did so was fine with him. Describing his moral improvement project in his autobiography, he wrote, "There was in it no mark of any of the distinguishing tenets of any particular sect. I had purposely avoided them, for being fully persuaded of the utility and excellency of my method, and that it might be serviceable to people in all religions, and intending some time or other to publish it, I would not have anything in it that should prejudice anyone of any sect against it." This simplicity of Franklin's creed meant that it was sneered at by sophisticates and disqualified from inclusion in the canon of profound philosophy. Albert Smythe, who compiled volumes of Franklin's papers in the 19th century, proclaimed, "His philosophy never got beyond the homely maxims of worldly prudence." But Franklin freely admitted that his religious and moral views were not based on profound analysis or metaphysical thinking. As he declared to a friend later in life, "The great uncertainty I found in metaphysical reasonings disgusted me, and I quitted that kind of reading and study for others more satisfactory." What he found more satisfactory, more than metaphysics or poetry or exalted romantic sentiments, was looking at things in a pragmatic and practical way. Did they have beneficial consequences? For him, there was a connection between civic virtue and religious virtue, between serving his fellow man and honoring God. He was unashamed by the simplicity of this creed, as he explained in a sweet letter to his wife. "God is very good to us," he wrote. "Let us show our sense of his goodness to us by continuing to do good to our fellow creatures." Poor Richard and the Way to Wealth. Poor Richard's Almanac, which Franklin began publishing at the end of 1732, combined the two goals of his doing well by doing good philosophy, the making of money and the promotion of virtue. It became, in the course of its 25-year run, America's first great humor classic. The fictional Poor Richard Saunders and his nagging wife Bridget, like their predecessors, Silence Do-Good, Anthony Afterwit, and Alice Addertongue, helped to define what would become a dominant tradition in American folk humor. The naively wicked wit and homespun wisdom of down-home characters who seem to be charmingly innocent, but are sharply pointed about the pretensions of the elite and the follies of everyday life. Poor Richard and other such characters, appear as disarming plain folk, the better to convey wicked insights, notes historian Alan Taylor. A long line of humorists, from Davy Crockett and Mark Twain to Garrison Keillor, still rework the prototypes created by Franklin. Almanacs were a sweet source of annual revenue for a printer, easily outselling even the Bible, because they had to be bought anew each year. Six were being published in Philadelphia at the time, two of which were printed by Franklin, Thomas Godfrey's and John German's. But after falling out with Godfrey over his failed matchmaking and losing German to his rival Andrew Bradford, Franklin found himself in the fall of 1732 with no almanac to help make his press profitable. So he hastily assembled his own. In format and style, it was like other almanacs, most notably that of Titan Leeds, who was publishing, as his father had before him, Philadelphia's most popular version. The name Poor Richard, a slight oxymoron pun, echoed that of Poor Robin's almanac, which had been published by Franklin's brother James. And Richard Saunders happened to be the real name of a noted almanac writer in England in the late 17th century. Franklin, however, added his own distinctive flair. He used his pseudonym to permit himself some ironic distance, and he ginned up a running feud with his rival, Titan Leeds, by predicting and later fabricating his death. As his ad in the Pennsylvania Gazette immodestly promised, "Just published for 1733, Poor Richard, an Almanac, containing the lunations, eclipses, planets' motions and aspects, weather, sun and moon's rising and setting, high water, etc., besides many pleasant and witty verses, jests and sayings, author's motive of writing, prediction of the death of his friend Mr. Titan Leeds, by Richard Saunders, Philomath, printed and sold by B. Franklin, price 3 shillings 6 pence per dozen." Years later, Franklin would recall that he regarded his almanac as a vehicle for conveying instruction among the common folk, therefore filled it with proverbs that inculcated industry and frugality as the means of procuring wealth and thereby securing virtue. At the same time, however, he also had another motive, about which he was quite forthright. The beauty of inventing a fictional author was that he could poke fun at himself by admitting, only half in jest, through the pen of Poor Richard, that money was his main motivation. "I might in this place attempt to gain thy favor by declaring that I write almanacs with no other view than that of the public good. But in this I should not be sincere," Poor Richard began his first preface. "The plain truth of the matter is I am excessive poor, and my wife has threatened more than once to burn all my books and rattling traps, as she calls my instruments, if I do not make some profitable use of them for the good of my family." Poor Richard went on to predict the inexorable death of his rival Titan Leeds, giving the exact day and hour. It was a prank borrowed from Jonathan Swift. Leeds fell into the trap, and in his own almanac for 1734, written after the date of his predicted death, called Franklin a conceited scribbler who had manifested himself a fool and a liar. Franklin, with his own printing press, had the luxury of reading Leeds before he published his own 1734 edition. In it, Poor Richard responded that all of these defamatory protestations indicate that the real Leeds must indeed be dead, and his new almanac a hoax by someone else. "Mr. Leeds was too well bred to use any man so indecently and scurrilously, and moreover, his esteem and affection for me was extraordinary." In his almanac for 1735, Franklin again ridiculed his deceased rival's sharp responses. "Titan Leeds, when living, would not have used me so," and also caught Leeds in a language mishap. Leeds had declared it was untrue that he had himself predicted that he would survive until the date in question. Franklin retorted that if it were untrue that he survived until then, he must therefore be really defunct and dead. "'Tis plain to everyone that reads his last two almanacs," Poor Richard jibed, "no man living would or could write such stuff." Even after Leeds, in fact, did die in 1738, Franklin did not relent. he printed a letter from Leeds's ghost, admitting that I did actually die at that time, precisely at the hour you mentioned, with a variation only of 5 minutes, 53 seconds. Franklin then had the ghost make a prediction about poor Richard's other rival. John German would convert to Catholicism in the coming year. Franklin kept up this jest for 4 years, even while he had once again the contract to print German's almanac. German's good humor finally ran out, and in 1743 he took his business back to Bradford. The reader may expect a reply from me to R.S., alias B.F.'s way of proving me no Protestant, he wrote, adding that because of that witty performance, he shall not have the benefit of my almanac for this year. Franklin had fun hiding behind the veil of poor Richard, but he also occasionally enjoyed poking through the veil. In 1736, he had poor Richard deny rumors that he was just a fiction. He would not, he said, have taken any notice of so idle a report if it had not been for the sake of my printer, to whom my enemies are pleased to ascribe my productions, and who it seems is as unwilling to father my offspring as I am to lose credit of it. The following year, poor Richard blamed his printer, Franklin, for causing some mistakes in the weather forecasts by moving them around to fit in holidays. And in 1739, he lamented that his printer was pocketing his profits, but added, "I do not grudge it him. He is a man I have great regard for." Richard and Bridget Saunders did in many ways reflect Benjamin and Deborah Franklin. In the almanac for 1738, Franklin had the fictional Bridget take a turn at writing the preface for poor Richard. This was shortly after Deborah Franklin had bought her husband the China breakfast bowl, and it came at the time when Franklin's newspaper pieces were poking fun at the pretensions of wives who acquire a taste for fancy tea services. Bridget Saunders announced to the reader that year that she had read the preface her husband had composed, discovered he had been slinging some of his old skits at me, and tossed it away. "Cannot I have a little fault or two, but all the country must see it in print? They have already been told at one time that I am proud, another time that I am loud, and that I have a new petticoat, and abundance of such kind of stuff. And now, forsooth, all the world must know that poor Dick's wife has lately taken a fancy to drink a little tea now and then." Lest the connection be missed, she noted that the tea was a present from the printer. Poor Richard's delightful annual prefaces never, alas, became as famous as the maxims and sayings that Franklin scattered in the margins of his almanacs each year, such as the most famous of all: "Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise." Franklin would have been amused by how faithfully these were praised by subsequent advocates of self-improvement, and he would likely have been even more amused by the humorists who later poked fun at them. In a sketch with the ironic title, "The Late Benjamin Franklin," Mark Twain jibed, "As if it were any object to a boy to be healthy and wealthy and wise on such terms. The sorrow that that maxim has cost me, through my parents experimenting on me with it, tongue cannot tell. The legitimate result is my present state of general debility, indigence, and mental aberration. My parents used to have me up before 9 o'clock in the morning, sometimes when I was a boy. If they had let me take my natural rest, where would I have been now? Keeping store, no doubt, and respected by all." Groucho Marx, in his memoirs, also picked up the theme. "Early to bed, early to rise, makes a man you know what. This is a lot of hoopla. Most wealthy people I know like to sleep late, and will fire the help if they are disturbed before 3 in the afternoon. You don't see Marilyn Monroe getting up at 6 in the morning. The truth is, I don't see Marilyn Monroe getting up at any hour, more's the pity. Most of Poor Richard's sayings were not, in fact, totally original, as Franklin freely admitted. They contained the wisdom of many ages and nations, he said in his autobiography. And he noted in the final edition that not a tenth part of the wisdom was my own. Even a near version of his early-to-bed and early-to-rise maxim had appeared in a collection of English proverbs a century earlier. Franklin's talent was inventing a few new maxims and polishing up a lot of older ones to make them pithier. For example, the old English proverb, "Fresh fish and new-come guests smell," but that they are 3 days old, Franklin made, "Fish and visitors stink in 3 days." Likewise, "A muffled cat is no good mouser," became, "The cat in gloves catches no mice." He took the old saying, "Many strokes fell great oaks," and gave it a sharper moral edge. "Little strokes fell great oaks." He also sharpened, "Three may keep a secret if two of them are away," into, "Three may keep a secret if two of them are dead." And the Scottish saying that "a listening damsel and a speaking castle shall never end with honor" was turned into "neither a fortress nor a maidenhead will hold out long after they begin to parley." Even though most of the maxims were adopted from others, they offer insight into his notions of what was useful and amusing. Among the best are, "He's a fool that makes his doctor his heir." "Eat to live, and not live to eat." "He that lies down with dogs shall rise up with fleas." "Where there's marriage without love, there will be love without marriage." "Necessity never made a good bargain." "There's more old drunkards than old doctors." "A good example is the best sermon." "None preaches better than the aunt, and she says nothing." "A penny saved is twopence clear." "When the well's dry, we know the worth of water." "The sleeping fox catches no poultry." "The used key is always bright." "He that lives on hope dies farting." He later wrote it as "dies fasting," and the early version may have been a misprint. "Diligence is the mother of good luck." "He that pursues two hares at once does not catch one and lets the other go." "Search others for their virtues, thyself for thy vices." "Kings and bears often worry their keepers." "Haste makes waste." "Make haste slowly." "He who multiplies riches multiplies cares." "He's a fool that cannot conceal his wisdom." "No gains without pains." "Vice knows she's ugly, so puts on her mask." "The most exquisite folly is made of wisdom spun too fine." "Love your enemies, for they will tell you your faults." "The sting of a reproach is the truth of it." "There's a time to wink as well as to see." "Genius without education is like silver in the mine." "There was never a good knife made of bad steel." "Half the truth is often a great lie." "God helps them that help themselves." What distinguished Franklin's almanac was its sly wit. As he was completing his 1738 edition, he wrote a letter in his newspaper using the pen name Philomath, that poked at his rivals by giving sarcastic advice about writing almanacs. A requisite talent, he said, is a sort of gravity, which keeps a due medium between dullness and nonsense. This is because grave men are taken by the common people for wise men. In addition, the author should write sentences and throw out hints that neither himself nor anybody else can understand. As examples, he cited some phrases used by Titan Leeds. In his final edition, completed while on his way to England in 1757, Franklin would sum things up with a fictional speech by an old man named Father Abraham, who strings together all of Poor Richard's adages about the need for frugality and virtue. But Franklin's wry tone was even then still intact. Poor Richard, who was standing in the back of the crowd, reports at the end, "The people heard it and approved the doctrine, and immediately practiced the contrary." All of this made Poor Richard a success and his creator wealthy. The almanac sold 10,000 copies a year, surpassing its Philadelphia rivals. John Peter Zenger, whose famous 1735 libel trial was covered by Franklin's paper, bought 36 dozen one year. James's widow sold about 80 dozen a year. Father Abraham's speech compiling Poor Richard's sayings was published as The Way to Wealth, and became for a time the most famous book to come out of colonial America. Within 40 years, it was reprinted in 145 editions and 7 languages. The French one was entitled La Science du Bonhomme Richard. Through the present, it has gone through more than 1,300 editions. Like Franklin's Moral Perfection Project and autobiography, the sayings of Poor Richard have been criticized for revealing the mind of a penny-saving prig. "It has taken me many years and countless smarts to get out of that barbed-wire moral enclosure that Poor Richard rigged up," wrote D.H. Lawrence. But that misses the humor and irony, as well as the nice mix of cleverness and morality that Franklin deftly brewed. It also mistakenly confuses Franklin with the characters he created. The real Franklin was not a moral prude, and he did not dedicate his life to accumulating wealth. "The general foible of mankind," he told a friend, "is in the pursuit of wealth to no end." His goal was to help aspiring tradesmen become more diligent, and thus more able to be useful and virtuous citizens. Poor Richard's almanacs do provide some useful insights into Franklin, especially into his wit and outlook. But by half hiding behind a fictional cutout, Franklin once again followed his junto rule of revealing his thinking only through indirection. In that, he was acting according to the advice he put in Poor Richard's mouth. "Let all men know thee, but no man know thee thoroughly. Men freely ford that see the shallows." Chapter 5. Public Citizen. Philadelphia, 1731 through 1748. Organizations for the Common Good. The essence of Franklin is that he was a civic-minded man. He cared more about public behavior than inner piety, and he was more interested in building the city of man than the city of God. The maxim he had proclaimed on his first trip back from London, "Man is a sociable being," was reflected not only in his personal collegiality, but also in his belief that benevolence was the binding virtue of society. As Poor Richard put it, "He that drinks his cider alone Let him catch his horse alone. This gregarious outlook would lead him, as a 20-something printer during the 1730s, to use his junto to launch a variety of community organizations, including a lending library, fire brigade, and night watchman corps, and later a hospital, militia, and college. "The good men may do separately," he wrote, "is small compared with what they may do collectively." Franklin picked up his penchant for forming do-good associations from Cotton Mather and others. But his organizational fervor and galvanizing personality made him the most influential force in instilling this as an enduring part of American life. "Americans of all ages, all stations in life, and all types of dispositions are forever forming associations," Tocqueville famously marveled. "Hospitals, prisons, and schools take shape this way." Tocqueville came to the conclusion that there was an inherent struggle in America between two opposing impulses: the spirit of rugged individualism versus the conflicting spirit of community and association building. Franklin would have disagreed. A fundamental aspect of Franklin's life, and of the American society he helped to create, was that individualism and communitarianism, so seemingly contradictory, were interwoven. The frontier attracted barn-raising pioneers who were ruggedly individualistic, as well as fiercely supportive of their community. Franklin was the epitome of this admixture of self-reliance and civic involvement, and what he exemplified became part of the American character. Franklin's subscription library, which was the first of its type in America, began when he suggested to his junto that each member bring books to the clubhouse so that the others could use them. It worked well enough, but money was needed to supplement and care for the collection. So he decided to recruit subscribers who would pay dues for the right to borrow books, most of which would be imported from London. The Library Company of Philadelphia was incorporated in 1731, when Franklin was 27. Its motto, written by Franklin, reflected the connection he made between goodness and godliness: "Communiter bona, profundere Deum est." To pour forth benefits for the common good is divine. Raising funds was not easy. So few were the readers at the time in Philadelphia, and the majority of us so poor, that I was not able with great industry to find more than 50 persons, mostly young tradesmen, willing to pay. In doing so, he learned one of his pragmatic lessons about jealousy and modesty. He found that people were reluctant to support a proposer of any useful project that might be supposed to raise one's reputation. So he put himself, as much as I could, out of sight, and gave credit for the idea to his friends. This method worked so well that I ever after practiced it on such occasions. People will eventually give you the credit, he noted, if you don't try to claim it at the time. The present little sacrifice of your vanity will afterwards be amply repaid. The choice of books, recommended by learned Philadelphians such as James Logan, a wealthy fur trader and gentleman scholar whom Franklin got the chance to befriend for this purpose, reflected Franklin's practical nature. Of the first 45 bought, there were 9 on science, 8 on history, and 8 on politics. Most of the rest were reference books. There were no novels, dramas, poetry, or great literature other than 2 classics, Homer and Virgil. Franklin spent an hour or two each day reading the books in the library, and thus repaired in some degree the loss of the learned education my father once intended for me. His involvement also helped him climb socially. The Junto was composed mainly of poor tradesmen. But the library company allowed Franklin to elicit the patronage of some of the more distinguished gentlemen of the town and also begin a lifelong friendship with Peter Collinson, a London merchant who agreed to help acquire the books. Eventually, the idea of local subscription libraries caught on in the rest of the colonies, and so did the benefits. "These libraries have improved the general conversation of the Americans," Franklin later noted, "and made the common tradesmen and farmers as intelligent as most gentlemen from other countries." The library company thrives to this day. With 500,000 books and 160,000 manuscripts, it remains a significant historical repository and is the oldest cultural institution in the United States. Franklin often floated his ideas for civic improvements by writing under a pseudonym for his paper. Using the name Pennsylvanus, he wrote a description of the brave men who volunteer to fight fires and suggested that those who didn't join them should help bear the expense of ladders, buckets, and pumps. A year later, in an essay he read to the Junto and subsequently published as a letter to his newspaper, he proposed the formation of a fire company. Again, taking care not to claim credit, he pretended the letter was written by an old man, who, in declaring that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, sounded quite like poor Richard. Philadelphia had a lot of spirited volunteers, he noted, but they lacked order and method. They should therefore consider following the example of Boston, he said, and organize into firefighting clubs with specific duties. Always a stickler for specifics, Franklin helpfully enumerated these duties in great detail. There should be wardens who carry a red staff of 5 feet, as well as axemen and hookmen and other specialties. "This was much spoken of as a useful piece," Franklin recalled in his autobiography. So he set about organizing the Union Fire Company, which was incorporated in 1736. He was fastidious in detailing its rules and the fines that would be levied for infractions. This being a Franklin scheme, it included a social component as well. They met for dinner once a month, for a social evening together, discussing and communicating such ideas as occurred to us on the subject of fires. So many people wanted to join that, like the Junto, it spawned sister fire companies around town. Franklin remained actively involved in the Union Fire Company for years. In 1743, the Gazette carried a little notice. "Lost at the late fire on Water Street, 2 leather buckets marked B. Franklin and Company. Whoever brings them to the printer hereof shall be satisfied for their trouble." 50 years later, when he returned from Paris after the Revolution, he would gather the 4 remaining members of the company along with their leather buckets for meetings. Franklin also sought to improve the town's ineffective police forces. At the time, the ragtag groups of watchmen were managed by constables who either enlisted neighbors or dunned them a fee to avoid service. This resulted in roaming gangs that made a little money and, Franklin noted, spent most of the night getting drunk. Once again, Franklin suggested a solution in a paper he wrote for his Junto. It proposed that full-time watchmen be funded by a property tax levied according to the value of each home, and it included one of the first arguments in America for progressive taxation. It was unfair, he wrote, that a poor widow housekeeper, all of whose property to be guarded by the watch did not perhaps exceed the value of £50, paid as much as the wealthiest merchant, who had thousands of pounds worth of goods in his stores. Unlike the fire associations, these police patrols were conceived as a government function and needed assembly approval. Consequently, they did not get formed until 1752, when the members of our clubs were grown more in influence. By that time, Franklin was an assemblyman, and he helped draft the detailed legislation on how the watchmen would be organized. The Freemasons. One fraternal association, more exalted than the Junto, already existed in Philadelphia, and it seemed perfectly tailored to Franklin's aspirations, the Grand Lodge of Free and Accepted Masons. Freemasonry, a semi-secret fraternal organization based on the ancient rituals and symbols of the stone-cutting guilds, had been founded in London in 1717, and its first Philadelphia lodge cropped up in 1727. Like Franklin, the Freemasons were dedicated to fellowship, civic works, and non-sectarian religious tolerance. They also represented, for Franklin, another step up the social ladder. Many of the town's top merchants and lawyers were Freemasons. Social mobility was not very common in the 18th century, but Franklin proudly made it his mission, indeed helped it become part of America's mission, that a tradesman could rise in the world and stand before kings. This was not always easy, and at first he had trouble getting invited to join the Freemasons. So he began printing small, favorable notices about them in his newspaper. When that did not work, he tried a tougher tactic. In December 1730, he ran a long article that purported, based on the papers of a member who had just died, to uncover some of the secrets of the organization, including the fact that most of the secrets were just a hoax. Within a few weeks, he was invited to join, after which the Gazette retracted its December article and printed some small flattering notices. Franklin became a faithful Freemason. In 1732, he helped draft the bylaws of the Philadelphia Lodge, and 2 years later became the Grand Master and printed its constitution. Franklin's fealty to the Freemasons embroiled him in a scandal that illustrated his aversion to confronting people. In the summer of 1737, a naive apprentice named Daniel Rees wanted to join the group. A gang of rowdy acquaintances, not Freemasons, sought to have sport with him and concocted a ritual filled with weird oaths, purgatives, and butt-kissing. When they told Franklin of their prank, he laughed and asked for a copy of the fake oaths. A few days later, the hooligans enacted another ceremony, where the hapless Rees was accidentally burned to death by a bowl of flaming brandy. Franklin was not involved, but he was called as a witness in the subsequent manslaughter trial. The newspaper, printed by his rival, Andrew Bradford, no friend of either Franklin or Freemasonry, charged that Franklin was indirectly responsible because he encouraged the tormentors. Responding in his own paper, Franklin admitted that he initially laughed at the prank. But when they came to those circumstances of their giving him a violent purge, leading him to kiss T's posteriors, and administering him the diabolical oath which R read to us, I grew indeed serious. His credibility, however, was not helped by the fact that he had asked to see the oath, and then merrily showed it to friends. News of the tragedy and Franklin's involvement was published in anti-Mason papers throughout the colonies, including the Boston News-Ledger, and reached his parents. In a letter, he sought to allay his mother's concerns about the Freemasons. "They are, in general, a very harmless sort of people," he wrote, "and have no principles or practices that are inconsistent with religion or good manners." He did concede, however, that she had a right to be displeased that they did not admit women. The Great Awakening. Although he was non-doctrinaire to the point of being little more than a deist, Franklin remained interested in religion, particularly its social effects. During the 1730s, he became enthralled by two preachers. The first, an unorthodox free thinker like himself, the other, an evangelical revivalist whose fiery conservatism ran counter to most of what Franklin believed. Samuel Hempel was a young preacher from Ireland, who in 1734 came to Philadelphia to work as a deputy at the Presbyterian church that Franklin had sporadically visited. More interested in preaching about morality than Calvinist doctrines, Hempel started drawing large crowds, including a curious Franklin, who found his sermons pleasing me, as they had little of the dogmatical kind, but inculcated strongly the practice of virtue. That dearth of dogma did not endear Hempel to the church elders, however. Jedediah Andrews, the senior minister whose sermons had bored Franklin, complained that Hempel had been imposed on his church, and that free thinkers, deists, and nothings getting a scent of him flocked to him. Soon Hempel was brought before the synod on charges of heresy. As the trial began, Franklin came to his defense with a deft article purporting to be a dialogue between two local Presbyterians. Mr. S., representing Franklin, listens as Mr. T. complains about how the new-fangled preacher talks too much about good works. "I do not love to hear so much of morality. I am sure it will carry no man to heaven." Mr. S. rejoins that it is what Christ and his apostles used to preach. "The Bible makes it clear," he says, "that God would have us lead virtuous, upright, and good-doing lives." "But," asks Mr. T., "isn't faith rather than virtue the path to salvation?" "Faith is recommended as a means of producing morality," Franklin's mouthpiece, Mr. S., replies, adding heretically, "That from such faith alone salvation may be expected appears to me to be neither a Christian doctrine nor a reasonable one." As a believer in tolerance, Franklin might have been expected to tolerate the Presbyterians imposing whatever doctrine they wanted on their own preachers. But instead, he had Mr. S. argue that they should not adhere to their orthodoxies. "No point of faith is so plain as that morality is our duty," Mr. S. concludes, echoing Franklin's core philosophy. "A virtuous heretic shall be saved before a wicked Christian." It was a typical Franklin effort at persuasion. Clever, indirect, and using fabricated characters to make his point. But when the synod unanimously censured and suspended Hempel, Franklin shed his usual velvet gloves and, as he put it, became his zealous partisan. He published an anonymous pamphlet, and unlike his newspaper dialogue, made sure that the pamphlet remained anonymous, filled with uncharacteristic anger. Not only did he offer detailed theological rebuttals to each of the synod's charges, but he accused its members of malice and envy. Hempel's accusers responded with their own pamphlet, which prompted Franklin to write another, even more vitriolic anonymous response that hurled phrases like bigotry and prejudice and pious fraud. In a subsequent poem, he labeled Hempel's critics Reverend Asses. It was a rare violation by Franklin of his junto rule of avoiding direct contradiction or argumentation, one that was all the more odd because in the past he had cheerily forsaken any claim to care much about doctrinal disputes. His resentment of the entrenched, pious, clerical establishment seemed to get the better of his temper. Franklin's defense became more difficult when Hempel was exposed as having plagiarized many of his sermons. Nevertheless, Franklin still stuck by him, explaining later that, "I rather approved his giving us good sermons composed by others than bad ones of his own manufacture, though the latter was the practice of our common teachers." In the end, Hempel left town and Franklin quit the Presbyterian congregation for good. The Hempel affair occurred just as an emotional tide of revivalism, known as the Great Awakening, began sweeping America. Fervent Protestant traditionalists, most notably Jonathan Edwards, were whipping congregants into spiritual frenzies and convulsive conversions with tales of fire and brimstone. As Edwards told his congregation in the most famous of his terror sermons, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," the only thing that kept them from eternal damnation was the inexplicable grace of the God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over fire. Nothing could have been further from Franklin's theology. Indeed, Edwards and Franklin, the two preeminent Americans of their generation, can be viewed, Carl Van Doren noted, as symbols of the hostile movements that strove for the mastery of their age. Edwards and the Great Awakeners sought to recommit America to the anguished spirituality of Puritanism, whereas Franklin sought to bring it into an Enlightenment era that exalted tolerance, individual merit, civic virtue, good deeds, and rationality. Thus, it might seem surprising, indeed somewhat odd, that Franklin became enthralled by George Whitefield, the most popular of the Great Awakening's roving preachers, who arrived in Philadelphia in 1739. The English evangelist had been an unhappy soul at Pembroke College, Oxford, and then had a new birth into Methodism and later Calvinism. He was doctrinally pure in his insistence that salvation came only through God's grace, but he was nevertheless deeply involved in charitable work, and his year-long tour through America was to raise money for an orphanage in Georgia. He raised more money than any other cleric of his time for philanthropies, which included schools, libraries, and almshouses across Europe and America. So perhaps it was not so surprising that Franklin took a liking to him, though he never embraced his theology. Whitefield's nightly outdoor revival meetings in Philadelphia, by then America's largest town with a population of 13,000, drew huge crowds, and Franklin, sensing a great story, covered him lavishly in the Pennsylvania Gazette. "On Thursday," he reported, "the Reverend Mr. Whitefield began to preach from the courthouse gallery in this city about 6 at night to nearly 6,000 people before him in the street, who stood in an awful silence to hear him." The crowds grew throughout his week-long visit, and Whitefield returned to the city 3 more times during his year-long American crusade. Franklin was awed. He published accounts of Whitefield's appearances in 45 weekly issues of his Gazette, and 8 times he turned over his entire front page to reprints of the sermons. Franklin recounted in his autobiography, with a wryness born only after years of detachment, the enthusiasm that infected him at the time. "I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with a collection, and I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper money, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles in gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften and concluded to give the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that and determined me to give the silver. And he finished so admirably that I emptied my pocket wholly into the collector's dish, gold and all. Franklin was also impressed with the transforming effect that Whitefield had on Philadelphia's citizenry. "Never did the people show so great a willingness to attend sermons," he reported in the Gazette. "Religion is become the subject of most conversation. No books are in request but those of piety." The financial implications of that last observation were not lost on Franklin. He met with Whitefield and arranged a deal to be the primary publisher of his sermons and journals, which no doubt added to his zeal to publicize him. After Whitefield's first visit, Franklin ran an advertisement soliciting orders for a series of Whitefield sermons at 2 shillings a volume. A few months later, he ran a notice that he had received so many orders that those who have paid or who bring the money in their hands will have the preference. Thousands were sold, which helped to make Franklin rich and Whitefield famous. Franklin also published 10 editions of Whitefield's journals, each 5 times more expensive than his almanac, and enlisted a sales force of 11 printers he knew throughout the colonies to make them bestsellers. His sister-in-law, Anne Franklin of Newport, took a shipment of 250. During 1739 through 1741, more than half the books that Franklin printed were by or about Whitefield. Some historians have consequently concluded that Franklin's passion for Whitefield was merely pecuniary. But that is too simplistic. As was often the case, Franklin was able to weave together seamlessly his financial interests with his civic desires and personal enthusiasms. He had a companionable personality, and he was genuinely attracted by Whitefield's mesmerizing charisma and charitable bent. He invited Whitefield to stay at his home, and when the preacher praised the invitation as being for Christ's sake, Franklin corrected him. "Don't let me be mistaken. It was not for Christ's sake, but for your sake." In addition, despite their theological differences, Franklin was attracted to Whitefield because he was shaking up the local establishment. Franklin's long-standing disdain for the religious elite led him to enjoy the discomfort and schisms caused by the intrusion of wildly popular itinerant preachers onto their turf. The tolerant Franklin was pleased that Whitefield's supporters had erected, with Franklin's financial support, a large new hall that, among other uses, could provide a pulpit to anyone of any belief. So that even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send a missionary to preach Mohammedanism to us, he would find a pulpit at his service. Franklin's populist delight at the discomfort of the elite was evident in the way he stoked up a controversy about a letter sent to the Gazette by some of the town's gentry, who wrote that Whitefield had not met with great success among the better sort of people. The next week, using the pen name Obadiah Plainman, Franklin ridiculed the use of the phrase "the better sort of people" and its implication that Whitefield's supporters were the meaner sort, the mob or the rabble. Mr. Plainman said that he and his friends were proud to call themselves part of the rabble, but they hated it when people who styled themselves better sort used such terms and implied that common folks were a stupid herd. A haughty-sounding gentleman named Tom Trueman, or perhaps given the name Franklin, pretending to be such a gentleman, wrote the next week to William Bradford's more upscale newspaper to deny that such offense was intended, and to accuse Mr. Plainman of fancying himself a leader of the town's common folks. Franklin, again replying as Mr. Plainman, said he was merely a poor, ordinary craftsman, who, after his labors, instead of going to the alehouse, I amuse myself with the books of the library company. As such, he rankled at those who proclaim themselves to be of the better sort, and look on the rest of their fellow subjects with contempt. Though he was rising in the world, in a way that would have allowed him, if he were so inclined, to put on aristocratic airs, Franklin was still allergic to snobbery, and proud to be a plain man defending the middling people. By the fall of 1740, Franklin showed signs of cooling slightly toward Whitefield, though not toward the profits that came from publishing him. The preacher's efforts to make him a newborn believer in Calvinist orthodoxy wore thin, and valuable patrons among the Philadelphia gentry began to denounce the Gazette's ardent flackery. In response to such criticism, Franklin printed an editorial denying, unconvincingly, any bias and restating his philosophy, first propounded in his 1731 Apology for Printers, that when truth has fair play, it will always prevail over falsehood. But he also included in the issue a letter from a preacher who criticized Whitefield's enthusiastic ravings, and he subsequently published two pamphlets harshly attacking Whitefield, as well as one giving Whitefield's response. The letters in Franklin's Gazette, 90% of which had been favorable to Whitefield in the first 9 months of 1740, tipped mostly negative beginning in September, though the pieces written by Franklin remained positive. Albeit with less ardor, Franklin continued to support Whitefield over the ensuing years, and they maintained an affectionate correspondence until the preacher's death in 1770. In his autobiography, written after Whitefield died, Franklin added a dose of ironic detachment to his